Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. Each week, Matt, Kurt, Jerry, and the occasional special guest explore how the trauma-informed paradigm challenges traditional beliefs and approaches concerning a wide variety of areas. This podcast addresses psychological trauma in an educational manner and is not designed to replace mental health treatment. If anything in this podcast makes you feel uncomfortable or anxious, please talk to a mental health professional.
Welcome, friends, to episode 43 of the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. I'm Matt. I'm here with Kurt today. We think Jerry's still in Scotland, maybe golfing. So we're excited to get the update from him. But Kurt, Jerry, and I are going to explore a concept that led me about two and a half years ago now to start a project that turned into the book Connecting Paradigms. And I know, Kurt, we've had a lot of discussions sort of about how we blend different philosophies, different approaches. We've got all these different best practices out there now. And taking that on in a deep dive to try to create a cohesive, hopefully I achieve that, a thing that looked like a book in the end, really made me realize I may have benefited from this thinking earlier on in my career, and especially when we look at trauma, because we're trying to a lot of times integrate the trauma-informed lens or trauma-informed, trauma-sensitive, whatever you say, into our existing philosophical foundation. So I think there's a lot of fun stuff for us to explore here in this episode. And we wish Jerry all the best in Scotland in his golf adventure. So for my bright shiny object of the week, I am sort of fresh off my own trip from Belize. And it's been a whirlwind. I was in Hawaii, I think about 2.5 weeks ago. I got back, I flew out to Des Moines, Iowa to speak at a great HIV a conference out there. So I want to say hi to our new friends in those two areas. And then literally flew from Des Moines, Iowa via Atlanta to Belize for I think it was about 9 days of just exploring a beautiful and wonderful country. It's so cool to see such a different culture. A very small country of just a few hundred thousand people and a lot of rainforest in there that there's not a whole lot of people living on. So we got to spend a few days in Belize City and got to really get a feel. We had a great local guide one day who showed us around and just to be in a different culture that's so, you know, like us, they were an English colony. Even though it was a very different history and didn't achieve, I thought this was fascinating, independence until 1981. So it's such a new country. We usually think of America as being new compared to like where Jerry is in Scotland, who's Scotland has seemed to have been around ever since, you know, somebody with a pin drove up that far, or didn't drive up that far, but got that far and talked about the people there. And so very interesting thing, and you have this ancient Mayan culture there as well. So if I drift a little bit, you probably won't notice the difference for most weeks, but I'm on my like 8th time zone and I fly to Boston tomorrow. So I'm glad to be here with you, my friend. And what's your bright, shiny object of the week?
Well, I'm gonna use kind of a metaphor, which I think will help us think a little bit about self-care and how to really, really dedicate yourself to self-care. So one of the fun things that I'm doing, kind of fun, fun at times, is house shopping.
Mm.
So I'm out
touring houses
and, you know, doing all that stuff. And it's really fun to think about kind of where you want to be and envision things. And there's, you know, it's something so kind of enjoyable about that, that it is a fun function and a really great function of our frontal cortex.
Yeah.
Dan Gilbert says it best, I think, that one of the things that we have is because we have a frontal cortex, we have an experience simulator.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to go through everything to imagine what it would be like. And it can really help you to make some really good decisions. It can also trip you up in some bad decisions, right? So that's fun. But I was noticing as I go through this process that you get attached to all these different people in the process, right? So My first one was a good friend of mine who's a mortgage broker. And so I called him and said, I think I'm ready. And he comes back and he's like, great. And we got this and we got this and we got this and we got this. And what do you think about these 10 things? Right. And then he wants to know what's happening with the process. Yeah. And he hands me off to a real estate agent. And the real estate agent says, great. What do you think about this? And what do you think about that? And what do you think about this? And then he has some needs that he needs to be updated on. And then you start touring houses and you start understanding that the seller of this house has needs. And I was kind of reflecting on that and going, wait a minute. Am I not, I'm the one spending this money. But suddenly what I need gets lost in all of these other needs. And yeah. I thought, what a great metaphor to being a part of the helping professions.
Absolutely.
That suddenly what you need and what you need to make sure that you're getting the value and why we picked being in this needs to be one of the things that we're really, really tied to. So I spent today with my real estate agent, you know, we saw, I don't know, 8 houses today or something, you know, and the whole day, right, I was listening to him kind of tell me about everything he thought about this house and everything he thought about that house and everything about this house. And I was just kind of like, yeah, I don't care. I don't care if you like this or if you don't like that. I don't care if the seller wants this or they don't want that. Here's what I want. This is what I want it to be. And I thought it was a great metaphor, as you know, thinking about self-care.
I love it.
And that the reframe for me was great. It was probably a much more stressless, at least mitigated stress, and enjoyable experience to just look at everything and just go, yeah, I don't care. I don't like that. I don't care if you don't like that. I like that. And that's what I want. And
exactly. Resale, yeah, you just want to play it
in a different market. Like all of these different perspectives, and I'm just like, no, I got to take care of myself.
Because exactly. You're the one that's got to live there eventually.
The most important opinion here. Yeah. And that's hard for, I think, a lot of people in general to do. And I think particularly seems to be difficult for people in the helping professions to do, because we got in it we find value in helping others.
Absolutely.
And that part of that means putting your own needs aside so that you can be available to help someone else. But there is a line that can easily get crossed in that, where your needs get lost. So it was a reminder for me, and I hope that it serves as a reminder for others that we can easily lose our own needs, and it's something to be really committed and dedicated to.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had to keep reminding myself. It's weird being on your own going on vacation, but I just, for all the people out there that I say you should not check your emails when you're on vacation, I spent eight days solid off email and 8 days solid off CNN and MSNBC, though. It was a bad thing. I turned on the TV because I love looking at local television, whether I'm in the States or a different country. The local access TV tells you so much about a community. And I turn it on and Fox News is the first channel that comes up. And I just turned it back off. I got to switch hotels before I just can't get past that. So I did a fair, but I didn't check the email, which I was kind of proud of myself. So,
I think that it's really cool. And we can kind of weave some of these points together, but thinking about what it's been a year since your book.
Yeah.
I remember, like, when we were doing an episode about the book coming out.
Yeah.
What a great accomplishment. And I mean, congratulations to you. I mean, I can't imagine putting all of my thoughts down into some kind of a coherent product. And the fact that you did that is incredibly impressive to me. So,
well, thank you.
I would love to hear kind of, what's it been like over the past year, and like, what are some of the reflections you've had as the book has come out and kind of gained a little traction, and we've had the podcast kind of tie to it.
It's
been a really interesting process to kind of be on the periphery of, so I'd love to hear some of your thoughts.
Well, yeah, it's really like a fun time to talk about this too, because I sort of, my business when I jumped and started my own thing was July 1st was that, and the book came out really just about I had a training in San Antonio where they got the first digital copies of the book. So, you know, this has been, you know, thinking 12 months ago, just kind of, even though the last few weeks have been like, I don't know where I'm waking up most of the time, you know, a very different sort of disorientation than what this was like last year. And it was like, I don't know, it's hard to describe when you have to put, and the book turned out to be about 200 or so pages, a little more than that. But, you know, and I don't think I've said this story on the podcast. It was one of those things, I just woke up in the morning. And I had this idea, it's like, you know, we don't talk, I haven't read the book yet that talks about how we help people make behavioral change who are struggling with intense trauma, who haven't really been able to have that healing experience yet, or maybe still, whether they're maybe in a child welfare or a juvenile justice or the adult system's homelessness. How do we help these people who we always ask to make changes, change when we know the neurobiology in many ways is set up to be counterproductive to making big life changes because of that consistent survival state that folks find themselves in, and again, at no fault of their own. And so I was like, I woke up and of course I wanted to write it that day. Like, I was like, okay, I got this idea. I can knock this out in just a few weeks and it'll be done. Of course, that was ridiculous. So I just realized, okay, I'm going to be realistic about this once I took a breath and realized I wasn't going to get it done by that afternoon. And just really started to do an hour before. Basically, I checked into my regular job at that time. And I just started to really put down, using sort of cognitive behavioral therapy, but really motivational interviewing, which for those not familiar with it, it's a really great intervention to help people really consider change. And we know best practice and evidence-based, one of the best researched interventions that there is out there. And I just really started to put these pieces together and found that, you know, even though I talked about so much of this stuff, stages of change, neurobiology, epigenetics, obviously the trauma piece of it, you know, one of the things that I realized I hadn't really put it all together in a succinct way. I think I put it together really nicely in chunks. So if you ask me to come out and do an MI training, I could give you a good 1 or 2 day MI training. Same thing with the trauma piece or neurobiology. And it really sort of made me step back and sort of reflect on my career, because I was trained as an eclectic therapist, which just in hindsight seemed like such a bad idea. And if you're not familiar with that term, sort of late mid-90s seemed to be when this was popular, but I had like a training in gestalt therapy. I had training in cognitive behavioral therapy. I had training a little bit even in like psychoanalysis, and we studied Jung. And I could basically do so many things, maybe halfway decently. But nobody in that class said, here's how you put all these together. And I kind of want to talk about that in this episode, because I see this happening in schools where there's, you know, Common Core is kind of the big thing, all these different positive behavioral supports. In the helping professions, we have motivation interviewing, but we also have a lot of the cognitive behavioral stuff, harm reduction we've talked about on this episode. So all these different fields, we have all these philosophies and foundations floating around. And it was one of the best professional exercises to go through for me personally, was to try to make that all fit. And hopefully, because a few people seem to buy the book each day, even though the audiobook's like surpassed the print book now, which I find awesome, because I love audiobooks. But putting those pieces together, and when I was kind of thinking about putting this episode together too, and we were kind of talking back and forth, I know you came from a real, unlike me, from my experience of you, is you got really well trained in a very specific and probably the most concrete form of interventions that we have with behavioralism. And I've watched you bring in much better than I did, especially early on, before I wrote the book. You've put these things like trauma, and you do this almost every episode, which I just love. You put these other things sort of into your philosophy, or maybe they complement your philosophy. And I just kind of, I would love to get your experience, who's somebody whose mind does this probably better than mine without having to write a 200-page book on the subject. Just sort of your experience kind of going from where you started with this really concrete philosophy and foundation to being somebody who can speak a lot of different philosophies and treatment modalities at this point in your career.
It's a kind of a difficult question to answer because you have to go back a ways.
Go back. I about made this about interviewing you. So this is you getting out of that podcast you didn't want to do.
I think probably the simplest way to say how, at least at this point, the way that my brain kind of processes information from any perspective is one of the things about the science of behavior that really just I gravitated towards was to apply a natural science-based methodology to the study of human behavior. And we've kind of talked a little bit about the history of that, which this was a long time ago when this stuff was happening. Yeah. You know? And I think it's one of the things that I wish that I could wrap people's heads around who are not trained in behavior analysis. Mm-hmm. That behavior analysis really developed not because John Watson or B.F. Skinner many years later ever thought that emotions were not important. Neither one of them ever thought that. In fact, they have written many things about, I never thought that. I don't think that. Like over and over and over again. You see the interviews with B.F. Skinner and Noam Chomsky way back.
Yeah.
Never thought that. Ever did they think that. What they thought was there were problems with the methodology that psychology as a field was using to study human behavior.
And was really almost all theoretical at that time.
It was all based on, I mean, it was interesting, right? You can see how when you read the history of it, how the research methods got developed, because they were interested in human experience.
Yeah.
That was considered to be the topic of the science of behavior was human experience. Right, so then there was a difference between behavior and internal experience, right? And they were trying to figure out where's the line between those things and how do we study this thing, which would be internal experience that only one person has access to. And so you have a problem with objectivity. And objectivity is critical to good science. Now, you have to have verifiable data and verifiable measures. And there are lots of ways that we do that now where we can actually measure and objectively verify what happened within the skin. Mm-hmm. And that's where really good science comes from. And so that's how behavior analysis got started. That's what it was. It was never this kind of myth that Skinner and Watson thought that feelings don't matter. That is just completely untrue. And I keep hearing it over and over and over again, like, oh my goodness, if I hear this again. Oh, kind of driving.
You know, from the counseling psych over in the other building, we looked at you playing with the rats. I just think, like, you know, what are these guys doing messing around with these rats all day?
Their whole point was, and again, we're talking 60 to 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Was that currently at that point, we did not have the technology to really see what was going on inside the skin. There's some real fun physiological research back in the, we go through the history of that field. Mm-hmm. They had, as they improved and that field improved its methods, then the sciences really are kind of coming together, right? We're getting good methodology. But even now you see things like the research methods in cognitive psychology or the research methods that led to motivational interviewing and that led to a lot of these interventions and new philosophies. When you look at what their research methodology is, it came from Watson and Skinner. Mm-hmm. And it came from those ideas of objectivity, measurability, making sure that everybody has access to the subject matter. Like all those things were very, very important. So that really drew me to this science of behavior. And then I had to go and learn. Probably I spent 10 years, if not a little bit longer, just learning that, like everything that I possibly could about it. And there's still many, many things that I don't know. I have forgotten much more than I have learned. But one of the things that I kind of pulled out of that study was that what was really important in any kind of field that you went into was to understand the relationship between physical events. And so that's what the lens that I started to use to really listen to what other professions were saying. And that's what I used to really decide whether or not what they were describing as an intervention or as a philosophy, as a way of looking at the symptoms or the phenomena that we were concerned with, really held water. Mm-hmm. Is it tied to what's the relationship between this physical event and that physical event? And that could be inside the skin, that could be outside the skin. I was like, fine. It can, either one is okay with me, as long as we can kind of distill it down to the relationship between physical events.
Yeah.
And that just helped me to have kind of a framework. And when Jerry and I had to go around that for, you know, months so that I could get my head around the language he was using.
Yeah.
And that he could get his head wrapped around the language I was using. Now, he still, I've never asked him this, but maybe he'll hear this. I don't know. But there were lots and lots of times where he would talk about a behavioral approach and say, well, like, feelings matter. And it, like, we can't just have this approach that feelings don't matter. I'd be like, I swear, I want to punch you in the throat, man. Like, stop saying it.
But I mean, it's fascinating. Just like hearing you talk, I think one of the interesting things about psychology, and it's been fun to be part of this switch, but when I was in school, we got a little bit about the brain, I'm sure, but it was kind of like, yeah, some of this stuff happens in the brain. Like, it wasn't anything, we were in the decade of the brain at the time, but it hadn't hit the textbook level at that point, much less the popular culture level. And it was just like, it fascinated me how we almost had to, you had to kind of pick, well, and this is more cognitive behavioral, do emotions cause thoughts? Do thoughts cause right. emotions? Right. And then you almost had to create this whole model based upon an assumption and then, you know, then put the behavioral test to it to see, does this work? Whereas I remember this one video, you might have seen it, but it was... Fritz Perl, wasn't Jung, it was Rogers. It may have been a behavioralist as well, but they put this poor woman through like three different distinct types of therapy. Of course, she came out saying she liked Gestalt because she felt more connected to the person, which really meant nothing, you know, when you think back. But that's sort of how we measured it. It was all that. It was, and I think qualitative research really has its place in the research continuum. But it's like you almost had to create it, and then you had to study it, and then. You know, we wanted to be so scientific that then you had to have the double blind studies, and they made us go through all those. God, I had so many freaking research classes in my graduate work. And all I learned from is I never want to run a double-blind study. But it's like we had to create these models. And I think that there is an analogy for a lot of the helping profession here is we almost like look at everything and try our best. And then recently we've had the quality movement where we then try to measure that. But we're measuring something with so many moving variables and parts and outcomes that it's like, as a ex-quality assurance director, I'm like, yeah, I can measure it. Can I tell you why we get that measure? You know, it's pretty tough. So it's kind of like we've almost just thrown this train together as it's been going along the tracks in an odd way. But again, I always saw behavioralism giving us, it's like, okay, this works. We actually found something we could measure quantitatively that works. Now we have something to hold up, then the cognitive behavioral therapy, and now all the trauma best practices as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I talk, and get a chance to talk to a lot of people kind of on either side of the eclectically trained versus the behavior analytically trained. And it's a pretty interesting time, I think, for all of these fields who are really kind of working together. And of course, I get oftentimes pulled into autism because of the Surgeon General's report about effective, you know, treatment for children with autism, and that applied behavior analysis is really good for that. I mean, it really is good for it. It also has some significant detractors and people who don't like it. And there are certainly the same issues with practitioner qualifications and variability across practitioners, and the same problems that every other, you know, field kind of has.
Exactly.
But there's getting to be a lot of kind of colliding, I think, between, I think the trauma world is a really great way to start thinking about some of the issues that people who are on the spectrum have that are really pushing applied behavior analysis to adapt the methodology. And there are people who are doing some really awesome work in really, really complex skills and social interaction and nuanced interpretation of like theory of mind things where you can infer somebody else's internal state and teaching that kind of a thing. Those are that getting on kind of the edge of those is really where some of the fun stuff happens. And there is this real challenge that I think that both, if we arbitrarily divide it into two camps, which I don't know if that's fair or not, but
makes for a good podcast.
Yeah. Either side is kind of like in this position of, do I make sure that my profession and my philosophy, which is incredibly important, like on the behavior analysts know that what they can do with a child with autism spectrum disorder and a lot of other disorders as well. I mean, I've been in the mental health field for, you know, like 15 years being a behavior analyst and the only one around for a long ways in that field. It's important that the quality and the implementation integrity of those interventions be protected. That's an important thing. Like, we need to have, if we're going to do evidence-based practices, which we should be doing, integrity, treatment integrity is a big deal. And so you've got to protect that. And you don't want unqualified people doing your interventions. On the other hand, integration is incredibly important. And so you got to be able to talk to other people who might not understand the way that you're talking about your intervention and your philosophy, and you can pretty quickly start separating like oil and water a little bit, and that becomes problematic for the patient. They've got to hold the integration piece, where we as professionals ought to be holding the integration piece and not kind of making our patients do that, our clients do that. But so it's an interesting dilemma that I think we find ourselves in.
Yeah, and my one of my questions that I'm thinking more and more about it, and I, again, the process of writing the book made me think, just so, okay, how's stages of change? How's, you know, mindfulness? How's all this kind of connect? And, you know, the joke that I had an editor, and when she got the first copy, and the subtitle is A Trauma-Informed and Neurobiological Approach to Motivational and Interviewing. Like, she's like, do you want to sell any books? I'm like, well, I know like the 8 people that will really want this book. And that's like, I didn't want to write what's already been written. So it's like, you know, this was the idea. When I woke up in the morning, it was like to get this niche, because there wasn't anything out there that I could buy on this niche. And the one thing that I think, in whether it's my trainings now, really my thinking, and I wonder if this bridges sort of this gap that exists, and also just to give voices that I ran a lot of programs without ever thinking about necessarily our philosophy that we were basing our rules, guidelines, policies, and procedures on. I will own that. In hindsight, I'm like, what the heck was I thinking? Probably because that's how I was trained as a therapist. Just a whole bunch of throw things at the wall and see what sticks. You know, the brain, you know, that in many ways, even for trauma, you know, for me, the brain is what brought my understanding of trauma to a whole different level. When I saw that there was a biological injury due to a traumatic experience, and then when I started to see the research on behavior and changing behavior means, to some extent, changing the physical structure of the brain, or at least how the brain operates, and then that changes the physical structure, is that, you know, I've started to throw around, and I'm sure I heard it from somewhere, so I don't take credit for inventing the term, but brain literacy. Like, I'm getting to the point where I'm not sure we can be effective in helping people heal or change behavior without understanding neurobiology to some extent. I also think it's very important that we feel comfortable enough to teach others about their own neurobiology. And I just kind of wonder, you know, from, you know, knowing behavioralism sort of started out outside the skin for basically practical, because that's what we could at least measure. Yeah. I kind of wonder how the growing understanding, because I know we consume a lot of the same books, with this, and I think this gives us the shared language as well to build all these great conversations I love having. How has the neurobiology piece changed your thinking from maybe, let's say, you know, 18 years ago or whenever, when you started thinking about this stuff before we had a lot of this information?
Yeah, when I was undergraduate, I had a really kind of formative professor, his name was Carl Cheney. And Carl had been a professor at Utah State when I met him for 33 years. And he knew B.F. Skinner. he actually took me and took me to Skinner's home, to the annual B.F. Skinner Foundation annual cocktail party.
The pilgrimage.
It was awesome. I had such a great time.
Yeah.
I met Julie Vargas and Ernie Vargas, who is Skinner's daughter and son-in-law. I met his granddaughter, who lived in the house at that time. And, well, you know, Carl was just this wonderful guy. And he was a professor not only in the behavior analytic courses, it was my first course in behavior analysis, but Carl was also a professor of the neurobiology courses. So I took them. Yeah. Right? So I took physiological psychology from the same professor who taught me behavior analysis.
Cool.
Right? And so when going back to that point of the relationship between physical events, right, physiological psychology was all relationship between physical events. They were just what we knew about what happened inside the skin. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of that was learning the anatomy, you know, the structures. And then there was a part of it that was learning the functions. And that was relationship between physical events, which matched right on to what I was learning about environment behavior relations. And that kind of sat for me in a little bit of a compartmentalized way for a lot of years. And my exposure then to the trauma field that made so much sense to me was the brain and physiology. Because I had learned that. I mean, I took courses in graduate school and, you know, was sitting around learning about the anatomy of the brain and of the stress response. And I took courses in neuroimmunology, which was really cool. And so I had gotten a lot of that information. And I had started to really see a lot of the application there was in classical conditioning or respondent conditioning, because we could really study the underlying physiological mechanisms related to classical conditioning. A little bit harder to study it for operant conditioning. You could take a drink because we
said take a drink.
I've had two podcasts in a row now.
I know.
So when we started to put the neurobiology onto what we were seeing with things like attachment, mm-hmm. or what we were seeing with how that related to state-dependent changes in behavioral responses, that just kind of integrated all of those things for me that have been kind of just marinating for a lot of years, you know? And once I kind of got that, then I became for, I'd say for 5 years, I read everything that I could get my hands on, primary literature, non-primary literature. I just read and read and read. And until I had kind of distilled this, that's where this idea of inside the skin versus outside the skin even came from.
Yeah.
It was a way to be able to talk to both people trained in applied behavior analysis and people not trained in applied behavior analysis. Because all the people who are eclectically trained, we'll put them all into that group, were super interested in what was going on inside the skin and super interested in creating hypotheses about what was happening inside the skin. And that will drive behavior analysts crazy. It'll drive us nuts because so much of it is not based on actual relationships between physical events.
Yeah.
Right? But it's on the edges of the things where creativity really kind of happens. So it's not bad that we go to those edges. Yeah. But it's also, you just have to realize that you're on the edge, right? There's a good thing about getting there. It's just that you got to realize that you're on a little bit shaky ground out there. And I needed to be have a way of talking to the behavior analytically trained colleagues of mine, because I was interacting with them a lot at the same time that I was interacting with non-behaviorally trained people. And I needed to have a way to talk to them that wouldn't get them to just tune me out and not listen to me.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we got these words of, that's a symptom that's happening inside the skin. What do we know about what happens inside the skin? Or that's a symptom that's happening outside the skin. What do we know about how that's interacting with the environment? It was a way of integrating those two things together.
Great.
Which was super fun. It was enjoyable to go through that process.
So I would love to get your take on this because, you know, again, one of the things I've already admitted on this podcast is, and again, maybe because my training was like this, is that we get so, and most of us jump into a program that already exists. And I think it took me a while. And really, I think the trauma and actually working for Jerry, where he had this philosophy, made me start to think about, okay, what is the philosophy and or science that we're basing this program off of? And, you know, I think we're doing a great job now, especially, you know, I think, again, healthcare, you know, is medical health, mental health. We're starting to get to that understanding, I think, more and more of integrating all of health and well-being, sort of at least under one roof. But even if you put that all in a, let's just say, whether that's a school setting, whether that's a federally qualified health center, I'm assuming here that probably the vast majority of people, though our audience is of course a lot smarter than the typical audience, but you know, if a lot of people are probably like me and may not have had those conversations with their peers in leadership, is okay, what is our foundation to build our interventions off of? A lot of times, and this is where I think as a therapist, we kind of own the therapy part of it, whether that's cognitive behavioral therapy or, you know, whatever EMDR, whatever that is. The health centers that I work with, then you have the medical model that's really heavy. And then you throw a bunch of social workers in the mix who look at it from, and then you got the micro and the macro social workers with different levels of training. And I think in some ways, and I've seen this a lot in like child welfare and other child services, sometimes you throw criminal justice in there as well. And we just kind of throw it all together and hope that it makes sense in some ways. And I think a lot of times historically, it hasn't made a whole lot of sense. And so, as we were planning for this, it's like, okay, what if you were talking to somebody as, again, somebody who thinks about this, and I know a programmatic leadership perspective too. Let's say a program's been operating without having these discussions about philosophy, foundations, what are we doing, why are we doing it sort of thing. Do you have any suggestions of how people might at least start to have that conversation?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely talked about that. And I think the first thought that I have to share is to understand that there is a big difference between a philosophy and an evidence-based practice.
Yeah. Big, talk about that a little bit.
There. Big difference. So a lot of people, when they design programs, tend to want to tie it to an evidence-based practice. Mm-hmm. That's not bad. That's a good thing. It's a very good thing. But an evidence-based practice isn't usually your philosophy. Mm-hmm. Right? An evidence-based practice is called that because it's gone through enough testing to be shown to be effective for a particular problem area, for a particular population of people. And that's really how it became an evidence-based practice. Now, there are practices like dialectical behavior therapy, motivational interviewing. Right? There's tiers of evidence-based practices in terms of what's been effective for a wider variety of people. And so that can be a way to kind of, for people to select, you know, what are the evidence-based practices that we're going to do? Mm-hmm. But that's not, in general, that's not a philosophy. I mean, it's too narrow to be considered a philosophy. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I do is create a model around information gathering and decision making. And that's my philosophy. Evidence-based practices fit into that philosophy.
Right.
And so I went to a great talk. This comes out of a talk I went to actually at the Association for Behavior Analysis International a few years ago. And it was given by, I went to it really because I was interested in the title. And one of the presenters was one of my professors from Utah State University years ago, a guy named Tim Slocum. If anybody gets a chance to study under Tim Slocum, do it. He's wonderful. And Tim gave this great talk where he said, there are evidence-based practices, which are, as I said, researched to be demonstrated to be effective for a particular diagnosis or problem area for a particular population or set of populations. And then he said, then there's this other thing, that is the evidence-based practice of mental health care or of healthcare systems in general, right? And I perked up. I was like, I'm getting, like, I loved what he was saying, right? I'm getting it. And so I developed a model that is the evidence-based practice is that you practice with the best information available to you. And you use that information and filter it through a lens through which you're trained, right? That can, you can be trained in a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. And you, whatever information you get, you're viewing it through a certain personal lens. So that goes into then making decisions and developing hypotheses about why this symptom is happening or why this problem is occurring. And so we gather information, we view it through certain lens, we go, here's why I think this is happening. Mm-hmm. And so I'm gonna pick this evidence-based practice to address this problem that, because I think it's happening for this reason. Then you implement that intervention, you get information about whether or not that intervention is effective or not. So you have new information to feed into the best information available. Mm-hmm. And you go through the cycle again.
Kind of the quality cycle at that point in some ways. So
that's kind of a model around decision making and information gathering that allows you to be flexible enough to use the evidence-based practices for the problems that you get in your program.
Right. Yeah, and I think that, you know, again, stepping in both as a consultant and also as an employee into that quality facilitation role, you know, I basically follow that roadmap that you just said is, you know, you try to take something that has worked for other people in some ways to really simplify that. But there's evidence that, again, this works with this population. And then, you know, measure, is this working to get to your goal, so to speak? And that, I think, you know, maybe the only language I add, because I think you really did well, is, you know, the question is, okay, what's our goal? What's a goal for a health center? When somebody walks through the door, and that goal is probably going to be individualized to some extent as treatment is as well, but trying to, like, okay, how do we best reach that goal and bring those pieces in? How do we measure our progress towards that goal, which was where the quality comes in? And then realizing, you know, I think I'm always humbled by the fact that the more complex, the complexity we understand about the brain is that each patient, each student, each client, whatever label we put on them that walks through our door comes in with a different neurobiology. It's not like we build one bridge and then we can build that bridge just with little adjustments all over the country or the world. it's like, okay, we got to, you know, create the relationship, attachment styles. There's all these variables in our work that I don't think we don't get enough credit for. And I think a lot of times we don't appreciate the brilliance that needs to happen on many levels. Cause even like MI, which I wouldn't say regimented, because there's a flexibility to it, which is why I think it is the best practice. But it's like, okay, do this now and do this now. And if they're in this stage of change, do this. But, you know, then you realize people are going through 12 major life changes at the same time. And so, you know, it's just that complexity of all of this makes, to me, this some of the most fascinating, challenging work you can possibly do. And then as somebody who's trying to measure the quality of that work, it's like, you know, put me in a manufacturing plant and I would be a quality guru. Tell me to measure the effectiveness of a federally qualified health center on the overall well-being of their patients. And boy, you're working with a such different starting point and a such different ending point that it's, yeah, to me, it's just a fascinating piece. And the other thing that I've to add to what you said that I really thought is, and this is more of a wonder kind of open question if you have any thoughts about it too, is, you know, when I look at things like motivational interviewing, I think one of the things that they brought to the cognitive behavioral arena, and again, not knowing the full history, I was trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, probably more so than anything else in grad school, is what they call the spirit of motivational interviewing. So they give this underlying philosophy, and harm reduction is the other one that I think is somewhat fascinating for this discussion, because it almost came out of a philosophy is that we don't know what's going to work with, you know, people struggling with addictions to heroin because it seems so overwhelmingly devastating. We have no idea how to help with the HIV crisis. And so this different kind of philosophy popped up that then things like needle exchange and, you know, other programs evolved from. So, you know, harm reduction is interesting because it was almost a philosophy that became a practice, or at least intervention. So, you know, when you were saying that, I was like, you know, I wonder if some of these are best practices to some extent because they had that deeper level of thinking about, okay, what's the philosophical foundation that we build these skill sets or approaches off of?
You know, one of the things that I appreciate about harm reduction is it is incredibly data-driven.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That's kind of, for me, that's the bedrock of it. Or it ain't harm reduction if it's not, right? If it actually does not reduce harm, which you have to have hard data to tell you whether or not that happened.
Yeah.
It's not harm reduction.
Yeah.
So I appreciate about that, right? Because it's a loop, basically, of going, maybe if we tried this, it would result in fewer people overdosing on heroin. Let's try it out and see what happens. Do fewer people overdose? Yeah, good. Then it's harm reduction. Yes. Great. Let's go through it again. So that's something I really appreciate about that model. And I just appreciate the ability to double check on whether or not what your intervention and what your practice is doing, whether or not it's working or not.
Yeah.
Even right down to one of the coaching that I would give to new clinicians a lot is as simple as asking their clients at the end of a session, how did today go?
Yeah.
did I ask the right questions? Was this okay for you? Rate me anonymously.
Yep.
Totally. Great. I can adjust that way.
Exactly.
And I think those are really, really important things to build into both our practices, like our evidence-based practices, and the evidence-based practice that we all engage in, regardless of what evidence-based practice you use.
Absolutely.
But I like those processes a lot, and I think they're you know, tied to back to a great philosophy, at least a value within a philosophy, which really is curiosity. I know I've mentioned that a lot on our podcast, and I think it's one of those just critical characteristics of a good therapist, a good human services provider, is the ability to remain curious and keep asking questions and wondering how things are going and soliciting feedback. I think those are all just critical practices to do, and it's a critical characteristic to hang on to.
Absolutely. And the final thing, I got one more question I'd love for us to tackle, but the one thing I think we need in all these deeper discussions about this. And again, I think harm reduction, again, gave me, when I was exposed to it, I just saw there was so much brilliance there. And then, you know, again, we see the real quantitative data coming out of systems who use that approach to their work is, you know, this was really designed by people needing help. It wasn't designed by a bunch of, you know, people in universities necessarily. It really came from the streets. It's like, hey, this is what we need, right? We want to get sober, but we can't get sober to get in your program. So what about us? And you know, there were these great movements in Europe and then the US. And again, the crisis of some of these movements is like, you guys are not giving us what we need. So let's try this. And again, I just love, it's just a reminder to me as you're having some of these discussions internally, if appropriate, because I know it doesn't work in all settings, but I would argue it does the majority. Make sure you get, like you just, the example, get client input on this too. I think sometimes we miss that as we get more and more kind of academic about stuff is, you know, some of our best approaches didn't happen in the classroom. They came off the streets. And
well, we know that we can always get you excited about a good grassroots movement.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So my final question, and you can kick this one back to me if you don't have anything right off the top of your head. But as we talked about, again, my experience of now I have the neurobiology, I can build a trauma onto that, the MI onto that, at least as a knowledge scientific base, to really help me understand the best practices and then when to bring those in as interventions in certain situations. I think the other thing, when you were talking about that process, it's almost, it mirrors a case consultation process too, is how do you work with the individual there as well? So making sure we have that flexibility, which is, again, is also tricky when all the best practices want you to implement A, B, C, D, E. And my favorite word is fidelity in some ways, because it's just such a joke in other ways. Because
hard to do.
Yeah, it would be great if the person shows up for therapy, but they only show up once a month. Right. And yeah, good luck with going A, B, C, and D in that way.
Being flexible but remaining true as you can to
exactly
the practice is a kind of an art form.
It is, absolutely. And where do you kind of think we're going with all of this? We've had the quality movement. We've got the neuroscience evolving. I think we're thinking inside, outside skin, maybe not as deeply as we talk about, but I nobody's come up to me and I, you know, from the psychology world, sort of my peeps, and said, boy, this Kurt guy's crazy, right? He doesn't get us at all. I mean, there's this evolving language of this. So if we're just going to have fun with the last, you know, few minutes of the episode, take us down maybe 20 years from now, when we're kind of old guys on episode number 4030, what do you think?
I have no idea where things are going. Well, I have some thoughts about where I would like to go.
Where would you like to go?
I don't know if the
field. As a therapist, I can give you the magic wand question. If I gave Kurt a magic wand, how would he change the future?
There are a couple of things that I am really, really interested in, and there's some certainly direction that you can see going this way of incorporating biometrics and behavioral measurement in correlating the two things. And so I think that's going to be, I would love to get, I mean, I've been using heart rate for a while now, and the ability to use some data, some hard data, right, on a heart rate, and use it in a way to stay connected to a patient and make sure that you're looking at a measure, actually, that is completely outside their skin now, because we have it as a number on a wristwatch or on your smartphone.
Yeah.
That is a measure of their internal state and a way to occasion you, really prompt you to ask what's going on with you.
Yeah.
That's such a great component of a therapeutic interaction.
Yeah.
It's a critical component of it. And it's a great way to use some data that you can then use to track progress.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you get a nice match between those things, and I hope that the field will continue to go that direction. I don't see a lot of reasons why it wouldn't continue that way. I certainly have every intention and plan of making that be a part of what I'm going to do. Okay, I'll make my contribution to the field going that direction in whatever sphere of influence I have. But that's what, something I see that will be incredibly powerful, I think, as it gets, we get better at it.
Yeah.
What do you think?
And well, mine is somewhat related to that, though I'm going to go a little bit more sci-fi on you, but I think we're talking about the same thing. I'm really fascinated by a couple of concepts that are evolving, and I'm not sure they're ever going to give us what we hope they give us, but it's that there's this concept in neurobiology now that we each have what's called a connectome, which is basically how the neurons connect and function to one another. And the theory with some really good science behind it, though I think the complexity, you can push this out maybe even longer. There are technologies evolving rapidly too, is that if we could, as a therapist who really, you know, the brain has become so central to my thinking, I never get to see the organ I'm trying to help work with. And I think even for me, it may not be as important for me to see it, but imagine somebody kind of seeing their trauma show up in their neurobiology, their habits showing up in their neurobiology. So while you, as you normally do, hit a practical, achievable sort of a balance with this, I sort of wonder, as you know, wearable brain technology that you can spend a couple $100 and get a pretty cool stuff off Amazon right now, biofeedback, yeah. You know, heart rate sort of plus stuff. And as that becomes, you know, think about if you're kind of our age, think 20 years back, would you ever imagine a Fitbit? Like, would you ever imagine if we were doing heart rate studies, we'd probably be taking people's pulse as they're, you know, having a blow up at us. You know, if we can, as our understanding of all this achieves, is get that connectome. And then, you know, my real kind of fascination with this that I don't think we talk about enough now is, could we do, whether it's psychotropic medications, but that may be too extreme in some of the ways I think, but just things like, you know, different sort of supplements, DHA, for example, that helps prefrontal cortex functioning. I think anti-inflammatory, again, not prescription-based stuff, but we know sort of the first steps in a healthy brain functioning, and yet I've not yet heard of anybody giving the DHA out, or is turmeric, I can never pronounce that word, but we've got these great anti-inflammatories, and we know we're learning a lot of mental health things are coming out of the inflammation of the brain. So if you take that, then if we can connect the connectome thing and understand brain functioning, and then support people with, if nothing else, supplements and diets in extreme situations, maybe something heavier. I don't know. I just think as we get to work with the brain in a different way, we may speed up and facilitate healing and our effectiveness by leaps and bounds. The brain's still going to change unless I'm missing something at a slow rate, because there's epigenetics going on in there. But then I saw something, what was I watching? Oh, John Oliver, I'm catching up on my TV and the CRISPR technology when we talk about DNA expression. It's like, you know, you can buy a home kit for CRISPR. I wouldn't suggest it to anybody to do it at this point. But, you know, we could, I think, really help facilitate the healing process, which obviously maybe if we put somebody in a great living situation and create the environment, connect them with great relationships, and then supplement that with all this technology. I think there's some, I don't know. I think psychology, behavioralism, all of our kind of medical care, you know, you see these kind of big breakthroughs that can potentially happen. And I think it'll be an exciting, the last 20 years have been amazing to be a part of. So
can't yeah. imagine how, where we'll be in 20.
Imagine what episode 4000 will be.
My sincere hope for getting that, like, better information wherever we go, right? Whatever kind of format we get it in, is that it does lead us to more integrated care and more integrated approaches. I think that's really important. And the better information we get, I hope that we can do that a little bit better.
Yeah, and I hope that we, again, find ways, because we know things like that Housing First program where we actually get people into safe, stable housing works, yet we haven't been able to get that into the consciousness of our communities yet. So that's where I think a lot of this best practice and quality stuff comes in, is sometimes we need resources to look a little different to get the long-term payoffs. And yeah, that's hopefully once we get those connectomes up, we can really then take the hardcore data, bore people to death to give us the right kind of funding to make real difference. So, well, this has been fun. And Kurt, I wanted to throw out, what about talking about some of the heart rate stuff for our next episode? I think that would be really, I know that's when I started to have my professional crush on you, at least, is when you and Jerry were talking about some of the polyvagal theory, and then I had to read the book, and yeah, the crush was broken.
That is amazing, isn't it? Oh my goodness.
But I think to talk about what resources and the innovation that you've been doing, I think would be a great episode, because again, we know that those systems are highly impacted by trauma. I think there's a lot we could learn there and nerd out about as well.
Yeah, it'd be really cool.
All right, so episode 44 next week, we'll talk about some of the great stuff that Kurt's been doing. We'll probably mention polyvagal theory?
Polyvagal
guy. And you pick up the book and it's so good. And yet, that's why I need to hear it from you instead of trying to read that sucker again.
I have to take it in doses.
Absolutely. So we'll get Jerry's take on that too. So join us next week. Kurt, thanks a lot. I want to thank everybody for joining us. I knew this was going to be a fun conversation. And you can always, as always, find show notes. We put discussion questions up, videos, links, all that stuff at traumainformedlens.org. And we'll see you next week. Thanks, Kurt.
Bye.